Okay, let's pick up where we left off in the book of 2 Samuel. We left off in chapter 14, and actually we're going through this this episode now in David's life, this time in David's life, where actually God is just bringing the judgments upon him that he had pronounced upon him through Nathan's prophecy back in chapter 11. Because of David's sin with Bathsheba, you know, God basically said that the sword will not depart from your house and that you're going to experience a great deal of judgment because of what you've done. As you know from chapter 13, it was Absalom who killed his older brother Amnon because Amnon had raped his half-sister Tamar. And that's where this story picks up. But before we read this chapter 14, back up to verse 38 of 13 so we can get into this the flow of what 14 says to us. So it says, so Absalom had fled and gone to Geshur and was there for 3 years. And the heart of the king longed to go out to Absalom, for he was comforted concerning Amnon since he was dead. In other words, what it's saying here is that, okay, after Absalom had killed his half-brother Amnon, Absalom fled to his grandfather on his mother's side. So long story short, that verse 39, it says the heart of the king longed to go out to Absalom, for he was comforted concerning Amnon. I think what it's basically saying is this, is that once Absalom had fled for refuge up to his grandfather's house, David basically reconciled himself to the fact that Amnon was dead. That's what that meant when it says here he was comforted concerning Amnon. I think that's what it meant, that he just accepted the fact that his oldest son was now dead, and he really longed to see his son Absalom. So that's what this picks up in this chapter 14. It says, now Joab, the son of Zeruiah, perceived that the king's heart was inclined towards Absalom. So Joab sent to Tekoa and brought a wise woman from there and said to her, please pretend to be a mourner and put on mourning garments now and do not anoint yourself with oil, but like a woman who has been mourning for the dead many days. Then go to the king and speak to him in this manner. So Joab put the words in her mouth. Now when the woman of Tekoa spoke to the king, she fell on her face to the ground and prostrated herself and said, help, O king. And the king said to her, what is your trouble? And she answered, truly, I am a widow, for my husband is dead. And your maidservant had two sons, but the two of them struggled together in the field, and there was no one to separate them. So one struck the other and killed him. Now behold, the whole family has risen against your maidservant, and they say, hand over the one who struck his brother, that we may put him to death for the life of his brother, whom he killed, and destroy the heir also. Thus they will extinguish my coal, which is left, so as to leave my husband neither name nor remnant on the face of the earth. Then the king said to the woman, go to your house, and I will give orders concerning you. And the woman of Tekoa said to the king, O my lord, the king, the iniquity is on me and my father's house, but the king and his throne are guiltless. So the king said, whoever speaks to you, bring him to me, and he will not touch you any more. Then she said, please let the king remember the Lord your God, so that the avenger of blood may not continue to destroy, lest they destroy my son. And he said, as the Lord lives, not one hair of your son shall fall to the ground. Then the woman said, please let your maidservant speak a word to my lord the king. And he said, speak. And the woman said, why then have you planned such a thing against the people of God? For in speaking this word, the king is as one who is guilty, in that the king does not bring back his banished one. For we shall surely die, and are like water spilled on the ground, and which cannot be gathered up again. Yet God does not take away life, but plans ways so that the banished one may not be cast out from him. Now the reason I have come to speak this word to my lord the king is because the people have made me afraid. So your maidservant said, let me now speak to the king. Perhaps the king will perform the request of his maidservant. For the king will hear and deliver his maidservant from the hand of the man who would destroy both me and my son from the inheritance of God. Then your maidservant said, please let the word of my lord the king be comforting. For as the angel of God, so is my lord the king to discern good and evil. And may the Lord your God be with you. Then the king answered and said to the woman, please do not hide anything from me that I'm about to ask you. And the woman said, let my lord the king please speak. So the king king said, "Is the hand of Joab with you in all this?" And the woman answered and said, "As your soul lives, my lord the king, no one can turn to the right or to the left from anything that my lord the king has spoken. Indeed, it was your servant Joab who commanded me, and it was he who put all these words in my mouth of your maidservant, in order to change the appearance of things. Your servant Joab has done this thing. But my lord is wise, like the wisdom of the angel of God, to know all that is in the earth." Before we go any further, I wanted to read this far so that we just get an idea, a flavor of the theme of what's going on here. Because when we went through the book of Numbers, we went through the book of Joshua, we read about the cities of refuge. Well, here's a situation where, you know, if you go back and you read in Numbers 35 and in Joshua 20, if you remember when we read there, where God had ordained to have six cities of what he referred to as six cities of refuge. And these cities, like I said, if you look on the map here, they're evenly dispersed on the east side and west side of the Jordan. On the east side of the Jordan, there was Golan, and there was Ramoth Gilead, and there was Bezer. And on the west side of the Jordan, there was Kadesh, and there was Shechem, and there was Hebron. And like I said before, these cities were strategically located. They were evenly dispersed throughout Israel so that anybody who accidentally killed a human being could actually get to those cities within a day. Those cities were staggered. They were evenly distributed throughout the entire land of Israel, both on the east and the west side of the Jordan. Anyway, long story short, Absalom, he was not entitled to go to the city of refuge because he clearly premeditated this murder of his brother Amnon. Because we read in the previous chapter, it was 2 years later, after Amnon had raped his half-sister Tamar, that Absalom took vengeance on him. So Absalom had been planning this for some time, and it wasn't just in a heat of anger that this situation arose. I mean, Absalom had planned that and premeditated that for some time, and he executed his brother. Now, here's the dilemma that David finds himself in, is that we are told in Numbers and we are told in Joshua chapter 20 and Numbers chapter 35 that anyone who killed somebody out of premeditated murder, the next of kin, had a moral obligation to go slay that person. Now, here's the thing. Who would be the next of kin, the closest kin to Absalom?
David.
It would be David, his own father. All right? It was David's responsibility to be the blood avenger, to go after his own son and to slay his own son for his premeditated murder of David's other son, Amnon. Now, see the dilemma that he's in? He's in this situation where he doesn't know how to deal with this, because by rights, he should put his son to death. But then again, by rights, he should have been put to death. You see, the whole thing has kind of come full circle, hasn't it? All right? And David, even though what he had done as far as having Uriah killed and committing adultery with Uriah's wife, David was told by Nathan that God had forgiven his sin. So you see, in a situation, you can almost see a prefigurement when Jesus comes upon the scene, when a woman was caught in adultery and the law of Moses said she is need to be stoned to death. And you know, Jesus still upheld the law, but he basically said to the woman, "Has no man condemned you?" And she said, "No." And he says, "Well, then, neither do I. Go and sin no more." So you see kind of a situation here where the law could not be changed, but you could see the heart of God in a situation where God wants to forgive, but there has to be a price paid. And, of course, there was a price paid. I mean, the child that was conceived through this illegitimate affair, God took his life. All right. But now, you know, I'm kind of rambling here. But if you look at the dilemma that David's in, by rights, he should go out and have his son killed or kill him himself. But he just can't bring himself to do that. So his son is in exile, and he's longing for his son. He wants to have fellowship with his son. He wants to be with his son. But he knows that if he brings him back to Jerusalem and brings him back to eat at the king's table, he is going to be really criticized by the people of Israel. Because they're going to say, well, you know, David, here he is, a man who executes fierce judgment on people who take other people's lives, and he's not about to do it with his own son. So, you know, they would just figure the guy's a phony and a hypocrite, and he doesn't have any moral backbone or authority or whatever. So he's in this dilemma. But anyway, Joab sees the mess that he's in, or the dilemma that he's in, so he devises a plan. He goes and has this woman from Tekoa. He apparently knew of this woman. She was had quite a reputation for being a wise woman, being a woman who was very, very articulate, could express herself very well. So he brings this woman to him, and he concocts his plan. He wants this woman to go to David and just tell this story. It's just a made-up story. But the story has a real profound application that Joab wants to make from the story. And basically, the story is this. The woman goes before David, and she, you know, spins this yarn saying that, hey, she had two sons, and she's a widow, and she had two sons, and her sons were out there in the field one day, and they got in a heated dispute, a heated argument, and one of the sons killed the other son. I mean, it wasn't really intentional, but he did it anyway, all right? And so the law demanded that this surviving son be put to death, and she was even saying that the relatives were demanding that the closest kin, the blood avenger, execute her other son. And so she's saying to David, if my other son is executed, then I'm not going to have an inheritance. I'm not going to have anyone to take care of me in my old age, and I'm not going to have a line to be passed on. David hears this situation, and he's basically saying that he'll take care of the matter. But then the woman just presses the issue, because in verse 9 she says, and a woman of Tekoa said to the king, O my lord the king, the iniquity is on me and my father's house, but the king and his throne are guiltless. In other words, she's saying, hey, put the blame on me so that people won't be blaming you for this. And then David hears her out, and he just says, okay, if anybody wants to take your son's life, then you send him to me and I'll take care of him. And he says, nobody's going to, you know, the blood avenger is not going to execute your only son. And then once he says that, then it opens up the door for her to say, well, this is exactly the situation where you and Absalom are in. And if you're willing to forgive, or basically to override this law of the avenger, the blood avenger, for me, then you should do it for yourself, and you should do it for Israel, because, you know, Absalom would be the next in line for the throne. So anyway, this is how this all pans out. But remember, again, when we went through Numbers, we went through Joshua, does anybody remember what the blood avenger really symbolizes, what it really points to? What's that?
Law.
Yeah, it points to the law. In other words, the law says an eye for an eye, a tooth for tooth, bone for bone, break for break, life for life. That's what the law demands. All right, so they were under this situation where the blood avenger had a moral obligation to take this person's life. But like I said, if it was an accidental situation, then the person was guilty of involuntary manslaughter. They could run to a city of refuge, and that city of refuge pointed to Jesus Christ. You had to be in that city. Otherwise, if you went outside that city, you were under the law. And if the blood avenger saw you, he had a moral responsibility to take your life. I mean, that all pointed to Jesus Christ. It all had its fulfillment in Christ. And even though the city of refuge didn't really apply to Absalom, because his situation was obviously premeditated murder, it nevertheless made this application. And so David could see, I don't know, just the reasoning behind it. He figured, if I let this woman's son, if I protect him, then by rights, I should be able to protect my own son. Pick up that verse 21. It says, then the king said to Joab, behold, now I will surely do this thing. Go therefore and bring back the young man Absalom. And Joab fell on his face to the ground and prostrated himself and blessed the king. And Joab said, today your servant knows that I have found favor in your sight, O my lord, the king, in that the king has performed the request of his servant. So Joab arose and went to Geshur and brought Absalom to Jerusalem. However, the king said, let him turn to his own house and let him not see my face. So Absalom turned to his own house and did not see the king's face. And you know, even though King David had him brought back to Jerusalem, David, even though he missed him, he longed to see him, he wanted to have fellowship with him, David said, he's not going to see my face. Well, what does that suggest to you?
He's still not faithful.
Well, David just knew that he would still come under a great deal of criticism. Because, in a sense, he's still showing favoritism. When the Amalekite killed King Saul, remember that situation? Or basically assisted him in suicide. You know, David had him executed. All right, same thing. What was the Ishbosheth? That was one of Saul's sons. Two guys
decapitated him and brought his head to David, and David executed them without blinking an eye. And so, you know, you see David time and time again in a situation where he was executing justice. But here, justice isn't being panned out, or isn't being brought out. So that, I think that David just couldn't bring himself to put his arms around his son, because, in a sense, if he did, David would be, I guess, would be afraid that he would give the wrong message to other people, that the law doesn't apply to him and his household. Yeah.
There is somewhat of a twist to all this, even more than what you're saying, that in that Amnon, by right, should have been executed for his sin against Tamar.
Right.
And justice wasn't served there. So in a sense,
yeah,
it's like Absalom, in a roundabout way, had some justification.
Yeah, but see, here's the thing. If Amnon had killed his sister Tamar, his half-sister Tamar, then Absalom would have been a blood avenger, and it would have been his duty to kill Amnon, and then there wouldn't have been a problem, you see. But under the situation, Amnon did not shed blood there. But you're right in that respect that, you know, you see a situation where nobody can keep the law. Here's where it's basically being brought out, that try as hard as you can. Man, things can really get convoluted and really get complicated, and one thing after another. And technically, David should have been executed. Amnon should have been executed. Absalom should have been executed. This is the dilemma we're all under. Because by rights, well, I don't care how good you are, we all have broken the law somewhere down the line. And that's why we needed Jesus Christ to come. Anyway, then verse 25 says, "Now in all of Israel there was no one as handsome as Absalom, so highly praised. From the sole of his foot to the crown of his head, there was no defect in him. And when he cut the hair of his head, and it was at the end of every year that he cut it, for it was heavy on him, so he cut it. And he weighed the hair of his head at 200 shekels by the king's weight. And to Absalom there was born 3 sons and 1 daughter, whose name was Tamar, and she was a woman of a beautiful appearance." Just in passing here, it's just kind of giving you a, you know, physical description of Absalom, saying that this guy was the most handsome guy in Israel, basically, is what it's saying. And he said that his hair was so thick, and it would grow so long that he'd only cut it once a year, I guess, at this certain time of the year when they'd go out and shear the sheep or whatever. He'd cut his hair, and it weighed, it says, 200 shekels by the king's weight, which approximately was about 3 pounds. Okay, 3 pounds of hair every year to cut off of the guy. And it says here in passing that he had 3 sons and 1 daughter, whose name was Tamar. Apparently he named it after his sister. But what's interesting is when we get to chapter 18, we'll discover that there was a time in Absalom's life when he built a monument to himself because he had no children. So obviously that time he built the monument to himself was obviously before he had any offspring, thinking to himself, well, I want to make sure that if I don't have any offspring, that I have a monument here to remember me. If you look at this guy, Absalom, this guy is something else. Look at his physical features. Now, don't forget this now. It says in verse 25, "Now in all Israel there was no one as handsome as Absalom, so highly praised. From the sole of his foot to the crown of his head, there was no defect in him." And then it goes on to talk about his hair. Okay, look at the emphasis that our society puts upon physical appearance. It is really over the top. Now, here's a big difference. The Bible does talk about in Samuel, where God specifically said to Samuel when Samuel was evaluating Jesse's sons to see who would be the king, and Samuel said to himself when he saw Jesse's firstborn son, he said, "Boy, this guy, he's got to be the one. He looks so big and so strong and so handsome." And God says, "Hey, you know, I've rejected him." He says, "Man looks on the outward appearance, but God looks at the heart." Now, look at this guy's outward appearance, and now when we read further on, you will see that this guy is a wretch. This guy, when you see what he ends up doing to his father, I mean, it just shows that everything was just physical as far as his good looks were concerned, but his soul was completely destroyed or distorted, or it was just a complete mess. This is what happens to so many people today. They put so much emphasis on the outward appearance, but what does their soul look like? That's the thing. When they stand before God, what are they going to look like, you know, as far as their spirit is concerned? Absalom may have looked very good on the outside, but God was looking in the inside, and this guy was just a monster of iniquity. And verse 27 says, "And to Absalom there was born three sons and one daughter, whose name was Tamar, and she was a woman of beautiful appearance. Now Absalom lived 2 full years in Jerusalem and did not see the king's face." Get the picture now. He's brought back to Jerusalem, and he's there for 2 years, and David refuses to see him. He figures, I can't reconcile what he's done, because people are really going to be criticizing me. So in verse 29 it says, "Then Absalom sent for Joab to send him to the king, but he would not come to him. So he sent again a second time, but he would not come to him. Therefore he said to his servant, 'See, Joab's field is next to mine. He has barley there. Go and set it on fire.' So Absalom's servant set the field on fire. And Joab arose and came to Absalom at his house and said to him, 'Why have your servant set my field on fire?' And Absalom answered Joab, 'Because I sent for you, saying, "Come here, that I may send you to the king to say, why have I come from Geshur? It would be better for me to still be there. Now, therefore, let me see the king's face, and if there is iniquity in me, let him put me to death.' So when Joab came to the king and told him, he called for Absalom. Thus he came to the king and prostrated himself on his face to the ground before the king, and the king kissed Absalom." So this was Absalom's way of basically being pretty darn persistent that he wanted to get back into good graces with his father. Because we'll find out as the story unfolds, Absalom needed to make this kind of reconciliation in order to be, I think, present himself before the people. Because his ambition, you're going to see, it knows no bounds when he begins to devise a plan to take over his own father's throne. But look at how persistent this guy is. When he sends a message to Joab, and then Joab then ignores him, sends another message, Joab ignores him. And so he just sets Joab's field on fire, and then that's really going to motivate Joab to get over there and find out what this guy's problem is. And I don't know, I'm just saying in passing, there's an old saying, where there's a will, there's a way. And, you know, I don't want to make that much of a mental leap, but I certainly can see a spiritual application when people will come up with one lame excuse after another, after another, after another, when it comes to going to Bible study, or going to church, or going to prayer meetings, reading their Bible, or really applying themselves spiritually. But if they really want to do something, they will find a way to do it. And it's just a matter of priorities. And here you see Absalom. Well, he was determined that he was going to see the king's face, and he was determined that he was going to talk to Joab about interceding for him, and he devised his plan. So, I mean, you know, it always shows me that if we're really determined, we'll find a way to do things. Anybody have anything you want to add or share to that chapter 14? Yeah.
Where does Absalom's mother come from? Was it from when David was running for 10 years?
Yeah, right. You know, if I'm not mistaken, her name is Michal, if I'm not mistaken. Let me just read. Okay, the sons were born to David at Hebron. His firstborn was Amnon by Ahinoam, the Jezreelitess, and his second, Chileab, was also known as Daniel, by Abigail, the widow of Nabal, the Carmelitess. And the third was Absalom, the son of Michal. Okay. All right, so it was Michal that Absalom was born.
Where did she come from?
Well,
Michal, Absalom's mother.
Okay, let me just read it again. So the sons were born to David in Hebron. His firstborn was Amnon by Ahinoam, the Jezreelitess. And the second was Chileab by Abigail, the widow of Nabal, the Carmelitess. The third was Absalom, the son of Michal, the daughter of Talmai, the king of Geshur. Remember, I was talking about Geshur is where Absalom escaped to, all right? But I think you're mixing it up with Saul's daughter.
This son shouldn't be the next in line then. He had 2 elder brothers.
Well, I was saying that Chileab, we never know what happened to him because it appears that he died at infancy because his name was Daniel. So you got Amnon, who was the oldest. Chileab was the second oldest, but apparently he died. We're not told that he died, but apparently he did because he's not mentioned ever again. All right? And then there's Absalom. So he's the next in line for the throne. You know what? I was thinking of going through 3 chapters 9, but we're just going to close on this chapter 15 because the problem with this episode about Absalom is that, like I said, it covers about 7 chapters, and there's no way to do it justice because it does. I think there's a lot to be gleaned from it. So anyway, we'll just go through this chapter 15. I hate to break the story up, but there's no other way to do it. Now, beginning with verse 1 in chapter 15, it says, "Now it came about after this that Absalom provided for himself a chariot of horses and 50 men and runners before him. And Absalom used to rise early and stand beside the way to the gate. And it happened that when any man had a suit to come to the king for judgment, Absalom would call to him and say, from what city are you? And he would say, your servant is from one of the tribes of Israel. Then Absalom would say to him, see, your claims are good and right, and no man listens to you on the part of the king. Moreover, Absalom would say, oh, that one would appoint me judge in the land. Then every man who has any suit or cause could come to me, and I would give him justice. And it happened that when a man came near to prostrate himself before him, he would put out his hand and take hold of him and kiss him. And in this manner, Absalom dealt with all of Israel who came to the king for judgment. So Absalom stole away the hearts of the men of Israel." Now, the reason I made such an emphasis about Absalom's appearance is because look at the progression of this guy now. We could always, I think he already sees something in his character when he went and killed his brother Amnon. Rather than dealing with that situation right up front, you know, he waited 2 years and coldly and calculatingly murdered his brother. All right, so you can see something in this guy's character. But even though he physically was a very, very handsome and appealing man, look at what he's doing now. Now, always keep in mind, who's he doing it to? He's doing it to his own father. And what is he doing here? Every time that somebody would go to Jerusalem, basically if they had they wanted to go before the king for a judgment, for a ruling, Absalom would call him aside. And he'd say, what city are you from? He says, oh man, if I were king, if I was in charge, man, I'd really rule in your favor. And then when anybody would come to him and bow down to him, he wouldn't let them bow down to him. He'd pick him up and kiss him and hug him. And I mean, people without, man, this guy is really, really something. Well, what does this guy remind you of? Doesn't he remind you of our modern day politicians who go around and kiss babies and, you know, they, you know what I'm saying? Doesn't it remind you of them? In my opinion, he's a consummate politician. I mean, he just epitomizes people who are insincere. Because what's really his motive? Does he really, really care about these people? What's really his driving ambition here? It's obvious. He wants to take over his father's throne. He really, really doesn't give a rat's behind about the people he's dealing with. And that's, to me, you see so much of this in our politicians today. All right? I mean, it's like all he can see is, hey, man, I want to be in charge. All right? I want this power. I want this authority. But he's stealing away the hearts of the people. But again, God is allowing this to happen because David is under judgment. But more and more you begin to see this guy's character. And like I said, there's a vast difference between his spiritual appearance and his physical appearance. So anyway, in verse 6, "And in this manner Absalom dealt with all of Israel who came to the king for judgment. So Absalom stole away the hearts of the men of Israel. Now it came about at the end of 40 years." Now, here's the situation. It's not 40 years. Now, we've had several different copyist errors in the book of Samuel. It's one of the very few books in the Bible that you will find something like that, but it's literally 4 years. Anybody in the Bible say 4 years? Right there in that verse 7. "Now, it came about at the end of 4 years." Okay, it just says four. Okay, I know that it's literally 4 years, but for some reason they had a hard time with that 40 because we've been dealing with that, you know, before too. It says, "At the end of 4 years that Absalom said to the king, please let me go and pay my vow, which I vowed to the Lord in Hebron." Now, here again, he's lying to his father. The same way he lied to his father when he told his father, hey man, I want to go shear my sheep and I'm inviting you and inviting all my brothers. What was his real ulterior motive? It was just to kill his brother. So now he's giving his father another line saying, well, let me go to Hebron. Because he says, I'm going to make a vow to the Lord. I'm going to pay a vow that I made to the Lord, saying that if the Lord brought me back here, I'd make this vow. Well, here, this guy's using God, isn't he, to further his ambition? And I'm telling you, this is what I see all over the place. And, you know, it just really incenses me when I see these politicians that are so anti-God in terms of the bills that they support or the bills that they sponsor or promote that are an affront to God, especially in the areas of abortion or the homosexual agenda. And these people will go out there and they will want to be seen with a Bible under their hand going in or coming out of church or going to a prayer group. I mean, they're just using God. for their own ends, for their own ambition. And to me, that's a serious sin. Look at that verse 7. Now it came about at the end of 4 years that Absalom said to the king, please let me go and pay my vow, which I have vowed to the Lord in Hebron. Now that was just a crock. That was a lie. All right? He says, for your servant vowed a vow while I was living at Geshur in Syria, saying, if the Lord will indeed bring me back to Jerusalem, then I will serve the Lord. And the king said to him, go in peace. So he arose and went to Hebron. But Absalom sent spies throughout all the tribes of Israel, saying, as soon as you hear the sound of the trumpet, then you shall say, Absalom is king in Hebron. See, that's his motive. It wasn't going to Hebron to sacrifice the Lord to fulfill some vow. It was to go there to launch a conspiracy, to launch a coup. It says, as soon as you hear the sound of the trumpet, then you shall say, Absalom is king in Hebron. Then 200 men went with Absalom from Jerusalem who were invited and went innocently, and they did not know anything. And Absalom sent for Ahithophel, the Gileadite, David's counselor, from the city of Gilon, while he was offering the sacrifices. And the conspiracy was strong, for the people increased continually with Absalom. Then a messenger came to David saying, the hearts of the men of Israel are with Absalom. And David said to all of his servants who were with him at Jerusalem, arise and let us flee, for otherwise none of us shall escape from Absalom. Go in haste, at least he overtake us quickly, and bring down calamity on us, and strike the city with the edge of the sword. Then the king's servants said to the king, behold, your servants are ready to do whatever my lord the king chooses. So the king went out, and all his household with him. But the king left 10 concubines to keep the house. And the king went out, and all the people with him, and they stopped at the last house. Now all his servants passed on beside him, and all the Cherethites and the Pelethites and all the Gittites, 600 men who had come with him from Gath, passed over before the king. And the king said to Ittai the Gittite, why would you go with us? Return and remain with the king, for you are a foreigner and also and an exile. Return to your own place. Now, what he's talking about there, he's talking about the Cherethites. If I'm not mistaken, I think some of these people were Gentiles, and some of them may have even been Philistines. But they sold out to David, and they were David's servants, and David figured, hey, you don't need to get involved with this. Why don't you just go back home? Because you're not only a foreigner, but now you're going to be in exile with me. And this is what they replied in that verse 20. It says, and you came only yesterday, and shall I today make you wander with us while I go where I will? Return and take back your brothers. Mercy and truth be with you. But Ittai answered the king and said, as the Lord lives and as my lord the king lives, surely wherever my lord the king may be, whether for death or for life, there also your servant will be. Therefore David said to Ittai, go and pass over. So Ittai the Gittite passed over with all of his men and all of his little ones who were with him. Now, just in passing, you see a man here. He's a foreigner, but what does he do? He's committed to David, him and his men. And now David is in distress. Now David is on the run. And this guy is going with him. He's going to be loyal to him. And David figures, hey, man, you don't want any part of this dogfight. You're a foreigner, and now you're going to be a refugee. Now you're going to be out in exile. Now you're going to have all these troubles brought upon you because of me. He says, hey, you know, go back in peace. And the guy won't do it. He won't hear of it. He says, man, I'm going to be with you come hell or high water, even if I have to die with you. You know, look at that. I think it says a lot because you look at a situation where Jesus Christ had, he came to the Jews, he came to his own people, and many of them rejected him. But then there were many Gentiles, and of course, all for the past 2,000 years, you've seen primarily Gentiles who have committed their life to Christ and been loyal to Christ through thick and thin and through good times and bad and even into death. And I think this is what this Ittai, the Gittite, kind of prefigures. And he says here in that verse 23, it says, while all the country was weeping with a loud voice, all the people passed over, and the king also passed over the brook Kidron, and all the people passed over towards the way of the wilderness. In other words, he's talking about passing over. He's talking about all the people that are going to be loyal to David, that are loyal to him. They're going with him. In other words, they're leaving the city. They're leaving the city in droves because they know that anybody that remains faithful or loyal to David, they're a marked person. And the city's going to be destroyed, everybody that's in it that's committed to David. Verse 24 is, now behold, Zadok also came, and all the Levites with him, carrying the ark of the covenant of God. And they set down the ark of God, and Abiathar came up until all the people had finished passing from the city. And the king said to Zadok, return the ark of God to the city. If I find favor in the sight of the Lord, then he will bring me back again and show me both it and its habitation. But if he should say thus, I have no delight in you, behold, here I am, let him do to me what seems good to him. Then the king said to Zadok the priest, are you not a seer? Return to the city in peace, and your two sons with you, your son Ahimaaz and Jonathan, the son of Abiathar. See, I am going to wait at the fords of the wilderness until the word comes from you to inform me. Therefore, Zadok and Abiathar returned the ark of God to Jerusalem and remained there. Before we go any further, here we got a situation where Zadok the priest, he's bringing the ark of God with David. And then when David sees the ark there, you know, he says something. I think it's pretty darn significant, because David is just leaving this whole thing in the hands of God, because he sees the priest, he sees the ark, and he tells the priest, look, you know, go back and bring the ark of God back. Because look at that, verse 25. And the king said to Zadok, return the ark of God to the city. If I find favor in the sight of the Lord, then he will bring me back again and show me both it and its habitation. But if he should say, thus I have no delight in you, behold, here I am, let him do to me as it seems good to him. Now, what does that show in David? It shows, I think, a situation where he's leaving the whole thing in God's hand, totally trusting God, and basically like what Jesus said at the Garden of Gethsemane, not my will, but thy will be done. I mean, he's in a situation where he says, hey, if God wants you to come back, I'll see the ark again. I'll come back in his presence again. If not, if he has decided that he's going to do away with me, then let him do what's good in his own eyes. In other words, he recognizes the hand of God in this, and he realizes, too, that he's under judgment, but he's willing to just submit to God's will in this rather than fight it. So he tells Zadok to go back and basically be the eyes and ears for him when he does go back, because he says in verse 28, see, I am going to wait at the fords of the wilderness until word comes to you to inform me. Therefore, Zadok and Abiathar returned the ark of God to Jerusalem and remained there. And David went up the ascent of the Mount of Olives and wept as he went, and his head was covered, and he walked barefoot. Then all the people who were with him, each would covered his head and went up and weeping as they went. Now here David, he's escaping from the city, and he says he's going up by the way of Mount of Olives. And that's kind of significant, too, because this is the time of David's rejection, obviously. But you see a situation that is a parallel, and I don't want to make too much of a stretch here, but you even see it with Christ. Because his people had rejected him, the world had rejected him, but there were said faithful few, his disciples, his apostles, that were with him through thick and thin. And then what happened? After he had risen from the dead, it says that after 40 days, he and his disciples, his apostles, were walking up the Mount of Olives. And there, at the very Mount of Olives, Jesus began to ascend into heaven. They were watching him ascend into heaven. Everybody had their heads up in the sky watching Jesus disappear into the heavens. And then two angels appeared before the apostles, and they said, ye men of Galilee, what are you standing there looking up for? This same Jesus who you see taken up before you is going to come back in a like manner. And that's very significant to me, because where Jesus ascended into heaven on the Mount of Olives, he's going to come back, and that's where his feet are going to stand. We're told that in Zechariah, that the exact same place that Jesus ascended into heaven from on the Mount of Olives, that when he returns, his feet are going to touch the ground on that same place that he ascended into heaven. He's going to, right there at the Mount of Olives. But here, David is going up the Mount of Olives, and everybody with him are weeping. Because in a sense, this is the time of Jesus' rejection. It really is. And the more we look around us, the more we see it. I mean, Jesus himself said that one of the things that would characterize the last days would be that the love of many would grow cold because wickedness would abound. And that's what we're seeing all around us. And also Jesus warned us in Luke 22 and Matthew 24. What was the very first thing that Jesus said to look for when he began to name all the different signs of his return? What was the very first thing that headed the list?
False Christ.
He said, beware of the false Christ, the false teachers, the false messiahs. He said the false prophets. All right, that's the first thing that led the list. And today, we're seeing false prophets all over the place. But this is a fulfillment of what we are told in Timothy. In the last days, you know, people are going to be deceived by deceitful spirits, and people are going to try to accumulate for themselves teachers and according with their own desires. And you get a situation now when you see David and his rejection. Well, it was almost a prefigurement of Jesus at the time of his rejection. All right, now verse 30, let's just read that again and we'll wind this down. It says, and David went up the ascent of the Mount of Olives, and he wept as he went, and his head was covered, and he walked barefoot, and all the people who were with him each covered his head and went up weeping as they went. And basically they're in mourning there because of what's taking place. And now verse 31, now someone told David saying, Ahithophel is among the conspirators with Absalom. And David said, O Lord, I pray, make the counsel of Ahithophel foolishness. And it happened as David was coming to the summit where God was worshipped, that behold, Hushai the Archite met him with his coat torn and dust on his head. And David said to him, if you pass over with me, then you will be a burden to me. But if you return to the city and say to Absalom, I will be your servant, O king, as I have been your father's servant in time past, so I will now be your servant. Then you can thwart the counsel of Ahithophel for me. Are not Zadok and Abiathar the priests with you there? So it shall be that whatever you hear from the king's house, you shall report to Zadok and Abiathar the priests. Behold, their two sons are with them there, Ahimeaz, Zadok's son, and Jonathan, Abiathar's son. And by them you shall send me everything that you hear. So Hushai, David's friend, came into the city, and Absalom came into Jerusalem. Now, I hate to leave off here tonight because this story is just beginning to unfold, but there's no way we can get through the next few chapters because it does cover a lot of ground. But just in way of closing, keep this guy Ahithophel in mind. This is a counselor, one of David's counselors, and all the counsel that Ahithophel has given David over the years has been very, very good advice. You know, everything he says is just so full of wisdom and insight and understanding, and he just has really made a name for himself. But also there's another counselor, and it says here that he's David's friend, and it says that several times about this guy Hushai, that he's a friend of David, but he's also a counselor of David. His counsel has always been very, very good advice, but it's very often it's not as good as Ahithophel's. But David makes his prayer. When he finds out that Ahithophel has turned on him, that he's going over to Absalom, what does David say? In that verse 31, he says, now someone told David, saying, Ahithophel was among the conspirators with Absalom. And David said, O Lord, I pray, make the counsel of Ahithophel foolishness. I just want you to remember that, because here's the thing. Ahithophel, we're going to find out, really gives the best advice. But Hushai's advice appears to be better. But it was Ahithophel's advice that was much better. So in a sense, David's prayer was answered, but it wasn't answered in exactly the way that he had prayed. In other words, Ahithophel's advice was not foolishness. It was wise advice. It was the best advice. The problem is it was made to look foolish. And in the end, this guy's going to pay a dear price for his treachery. And, he sends back his friend. Now, what did Jesus say about friends? Because when we went through the Gospel of John, when Jesus said, I think it was the 15th chapter, he basically said, greater love has no one than this, that he lay down his life for his friends. You are my friends if you do what I command you. No longer did I call you slaves, for a slave does not know what his master is doing, but I have called you friends. For all things that I have heard from my Father, I have made known to you. And you see a situation where this is the friend who sticks by David through thick and thin. He's willing to lay his life down for David. This other counselor, obviously he led David to believe for many years that he was a friend, but he's selling him out. He's being treacherous. You know, there's an old saying, if a man serves God for money, he'll serve the devil for a raise. And apparently this Ahithophel was that kind of a man. As long as he was in the portals of power and prestige, as long as he was there, you could depend upon him. But when the tables are turned and it looks like Absalom is now going to be king, then he throws his lot in with him rather than being loyal to David. And I do think that there are a lot of people today that are just mere opportunists in a sense that they're really not sold out to Christ, committed to Christ. They're not going to follow him, come thick or thin, through good times and bad, they're just basically fair weather friends, and I think that there's more and more people like that today, and I certainly see this in this man Ahithophel. So anyway, anybody have anything want to add or share before we, yeah?
How old was David and how old was Absalom?
Okay, we don't know for exactly how old, but I would be willing to bet or venture to bet, to say that he's probably in his mid-50s at this particular time. Well, no, I would say he's even older than that. He's probably maybe, well, around 60. And this is just an educated guess, okay? It's just an educated guess, because I know that he dies at 70, all right? But considering the age of Absalom, which, you know, he's Absalom is a young man. He's probably in his 20s. I'm assuming that David's probably late 50s, early 60s at this particular time, you know, when this is happening to him. Anybody else have anyone to add? Sure.
Yeah,